Hello and welcome to Rob and Rachel's Rundown to the Games.
Right, we could talk about track athletes all day long, but time is pressing. So let's get to some of the legends of the field. And when it comes to throwers, we're going to park Al Erter four in a row in the discus 50s and 60s for America just for a second, because we're going to focus on the incredible, incredible javelin thrower, Jan Zalesny. Silver in 88. And then a hat-trick of golds, always denying Great Britain's Steve Backley. Zalesny is an all-time great. Of that, there is no doubt. And that is why Transworld Sport caught up with him in 1997, in the middle of his monumental gold rush.
On the morning of the Olympic final, they took away my world record. I was well prepared anyway and confident that I could win. But when they did that, it motivated me even more. And there was no way I was going to lose. There's the World Championships to look forward to, of course. But the main reason I keep throwing is my love of the javelin. I didn't take up the sport for the medals. It was because I enjoyed it.
Absolute privilege to hear the thoughts of Jan Zalesny. And it's fantastic that he's still on the athletic circuit now as a well-renowned coach. And Rachel, what is so impressive about Zalesny was his ability to move with the technical demands of an incredibly tough event. There's so much more going on in field events than first meets the eye to non-athletics aficionados.
Yeah, I mean, that brings me to the high jump, which if you've ever watched any archive footage of the high jump, and I'm talking like 100 years ago, you'll see people trying to do a kind of scissor kick over the bar. Or they actually started, didn't they, first just standing, a standing kind of high jump. So you just stood there, you kind of swung your arms a bit, and just tried to see how high you could go. And then in 1968, there was this civil engineering student. He came up with the idea of something a little bit different in the high jump. His name was Dick Fosbury, and I probably don't even need to tell you what he came up with. Fosbury flop, of course, was his idea. He realised that you had to look at the direction that you were running in, and you kind of run in a little bit of a curve. If you've ever watched the high jump event, you start very close to the corner of a track, either kind of the 100-metre bend or the 200-metre bend, and you kind of arch around. And he realised if you rotate your body backwards and you arch your back as you're running to get the momentum, you can just flop over the bar rather than scissor kicking. And that obviously paid dividends for him, because he got 2 metres and 24 in the Olympics in Mexico 68, and a gold medal as well with it.
Well, to change the way the sport is conducted at that intrinsic level is an incredible legacy,
and
let alone the gold.
He was the only one doing it, remember? Everyone else was looking at him going, are you crazy? Obviously not, when he got 2.24 and the gold medal to change history.
Right. Agreed. For all that he contributed to the sport, as well as his gold medal, Fosbury's in the conversation.
You've done a high jump before, Rob. Have you tried the scissors or the flop?
Scissors. Right. It was primary school. It was primary school. It was a long, long time ago. At least I cleared 1 metre. Anyway, let's move on very rapidly. Okay, if you mention Fosbury, before we get to an incredible story from Tokyo 2020, I know it was in 21, but we always refer to it as Tokyo 2020. That's how it was marketed. We've got to mention with high jump, the unbelievable, unbelievable Javier Sotomayor. Cuban boycott in 88, 17 days before the Games, broke the world record 2.42. And I know, coulda, woulda, shoulda, he probably would have been the champion in 88 before winning in 92. And he got the silver in Sydney. 4 world indoor titles, 2 outdoor, 93 and 97. 5 times he's gone over 2.42. And if you ever visit the Olympic Museum in Lausanne, his world record still stands 2.45. The entrance to the Olympic Museum has Sotomayor's bar over the top, and you stand underneath it and you look up and you think it is physically impossible for a human being to get every element of their body over that bar, because you'd go some to jump and touch it. It's absolutely incredible. So Fosbury, great, 68. Sotomayor, because of the boycott in 88, because of all the world records and because of the gold in 92 in Barcelona and getting the silver in Sydney, Sotomayor's in the conversation. Speaking of not being able to get close to records, Stringer, I know you are desperate, desperate to talk about a young American who leapt almost 7 feet in the air and almost 9 meters long ways in 68. The Beeman.
The leap of the century, it was known as, it is still known as, 1968, like you mentioned. For Transworld Sport, we caught up with him in 1991 to reflect on that historic moment.
My thoughts, my thinking pattern was strictly, let's get the gold medal. And that's all that I was there for, and nothing else. The next day, I was just feeling very loose, very confident. I'm here 3,000 miles away from home, and I need to come back with a gold medal. And I just felt like everything was in sync. And then I hit the board, and then bam. I'm not sure if I was in the air longer, but when I landed, I said, wow, I jumped out the pit and started jumping out the pit. And then I turned around and I saw the white flag and I said, oh, this is great. And then when they plastered it up on the board, it came up 8 meters 90. I said, wow, 8 meters 90. Maybe that's a shot put or a discus or something, you know. So my teammate Ralph Boston said, Bob, you just jumped 29 feet. Holy smokes. I just walked around for a minute and then it hit me, 29 feet. And I collapsed.
I mean, that was just incredible, wasn't it? It absolutely came out of nowhere. 6 seconds is what it took for the 22-year-old to run down the tarmac there. 19 strides it was, Rob Walker. And he leapt, not knowing how good it was. He said, I thought it was quite good, but I wasn't quite sure how good. How good it was 8 metres, 90 centimetres, 57 centimetres further than he'd ever gone before. The fun fact for me as well, it took about 15 to 20 minutes for them to record that because they had this new cool technology which was going to measure these jumps. And the new cool technology couldn't measure a jump that far. So they had to revert to the tape measuring. And they had so many people surrounding the long jump pit at the time to keep checking, rechecking, that I don't know what must have been going through his head there. Had he made a mistake? Was it looking like a foul? No, in the end, it was just too long. And that's why I guess they were so shocked at the length it was. I guess some people then, they kind of go, well, the fact that it was the altitude in Mexico, you know, does it stand? But I was also looking at second place. Do you know how far back second place who took the silver was in terms of centimetres?
No, go on.
71 centimetres. 8 metres and 19 were second place. 71 centimetres. I'm trying to do a little bit of a calculation if you're watching it. No, is it that big?
That's a huge margin.
We're not very good at obviously how long the ruler is, but 71 centimetres back got you silver.
But the reason for that, and I've got this tomb of a guide by Wolaczynski.
It's an Olympic compendium, yeah. This is, guys.
The reason for that is that everyone else, because Beeman did that jump in the first round, everybody else who was a favourite for a medal was psychologically broken.
You would be, wouldn't you?
Broken. Yeah. Lynn Davis said to him, I don't know why we're all here. Lynn Davis had won the gold brilliantly, a fantastically charismatic Welshman who won the gold for Great Britain. So he was there desperately hoping to successfully defend his title. He said to Bob Beeman, you have just destroyed this event. You have destroyed the event. And anybody else who'd previously been in line for a medal was psychologically broken. And that's why the gap down to silver and bronze was so huge. There's so many stories about Beeman that he referred to there in the brilliant Transworld Sport interview, that he had this kind of moment where he collapsed. Doctors actually worked out, I have had to look this up and I wouldn't spell it, he actually had a cataplegic seizure, which is where your whole body goes into shock. There's fantastic photographs, if you look them up online, as to what happened to him afterwards. I'm going to read you a little story from my Wolaczynski. I don't know whether the producer, Ben, is going to allow this. And I didn't know this until I'd decided to fully research this more than just the usual colloquial stuff that you come out with about Beeman. something happened to him the night before, which he had never...
Where are we going?
Which he had never done before in a competition. And it's this, right? So he'd had a nightmare in qualification, but just about managed to get himself over the line. And this is what happened.
That is really right. You could have done 71 centimetres on there as well.
The night before the most important final of his career, Bob Beamon did something he'd never done before. He engaged in sexual intercourse before a major competition final.
I knew we were going there.
At the moment of orgasm, it's in the Wallachinsky, so it must have happened, although he wasn't in the room at the time, I'm reliably informed. At the moment of orgasm, he was suddenly overcome with a horrible feeling that he'd blown it, that his chances for a gold and for the world record he'd boldly predicted had been thrown away right there and then in the bed. Thank you and good night. It was the perfect build-up.
Relax, right? Yeah, drink as well, I read. There we go. Let's move on swiftly from that. I pretty much knew we were going there. Can I just take this? Because I was trying to show you. That's 30 centimetres.
Yes, so 71 is a gigantic margin.
And 55, that's how much further they'd gone from the last record. So it was probably that. We're not talking about centimetres, we're talking about 55, half a metre. Anyway, should we move on? Put the ruler back in your book. Where are we going now?
From one great to another. Now, some would say not a great because only one gold in the Olympics, but 35 world records. He won the first six editions of the World Championship, and I think he does count as a great.
Yeah.
The one and only Sergei Bubka, who yet again let the cameras from Transworld Sport in as he was preparing for his final games in Donetsk in 2000.
The nature of man is such that the tougher the conditions, the greater his resistance. His character strengthens. He becomes a stronger person. This is one of the main reasons I've returned home. The standard of living is nowhere near as high in the Ukraine compared to Monte Carlo. But in a strange way, being here gives me the stimulus and spirit to fight for my place in the world. I think I'll definitely achieve more by being back home. Difficulties do occur with age. I know I'm not a kid anymore, so I've had to change my training regime. When I was younger, I never used to stop. Now I train in shorter bursts, but with greater intensity. The basic principle has always remained the same, hard work. Pole vaulting is unique in the fact that it's made up of both athletics and gymnastics. You must have the strength, of course, but you must also generate enough speed down the runway. Then you've got to have the agility for the vault itself. Technically and psychologically, you have to be perfect.
Well, let's pick up then on Bubka. As I mentioned, only one Olympic gold, but still deserves to be in this conversation. That was Seoul in 1988. That was the only medal he had. Because then we have to look back as well. 84, the games were in LA, and we know what happened there. Soviet Union, they boycotted it. And Bubka would have been a sure for the gold medal in that one. It would have been two, wasn't to be. And then in 92, Barcelona, I think he'd won every single event in the build-up to the 92 games. And again, just a little bit of bad luck. He said he was not really feeling like himself. He didn't kind of register a mark, did he, in the final of that games? Kind of looked down and go, well, where did he finish? Right at the bottom there. DNF next to his name. But actually, I feel after that, it kind of maybe changed his motivation. He came out and said, well, it shows I'm not a machine. I am a human being. And sometimes things don't go to plan. It's just bad luck, isn't it, when it comes around once every 4 years. Then in 1996, Atlanta, he was injured in that one. So again, unlucky still. And then 2000 at Sydney, it was a repeat, wasn't it, from what happened in Barcelona as well. He failed to score a mark. So I guess people would question if he's the greatest of all time, if he can't perform on the Olympic stage every 4 years when it matters. Injury, you possibly put that to the side. Six world championships, numerous world records, but is it about the games? Do you have to make it all count? The games, you have to be ready for that. You can't not get a score on the board.
Well, you can't call him the greatest Olympic pole vaulter because he hasn't won multiple golds. However, he is in the conversation because of how far he moved the sport on. He wouldn't be in the conversation had he not got the gold in Seoul. He couldn't do anything about the boycott in 84. That's desperately unlucky, in the same way that Ed Moses was desperately unlucky, the American 400 hurdler. When he won in 76 and 84, he arguably would have gone three in a row, probably, if the Americans hadn't boycotted in Moscow in 1980. But I think the fact that Bubka was such an instrumental figure in taking pole vaulting on to a new generation, and, you know,
and to
in,
new heights as well.
Yeah,
first man
30,
six,
35
six
world records. He won the first six world titles. And bear in mind, at that time, in the early editions, the Worlds was only every 4 years as well. The fact, what it does show you, it absolutely underlines how difficult it is to become an Olympic champion when you've got somebody who dominated his sport for the best part of two decades, only managing to climb the Olympic mountain once, when you would have expected two or three in comparison to his six successive world outdoor titles. So Bubka's in the conversation, but he's not at the top of the pile. Now, look, we could talk all day, and we have done already. The editor's got a nightmare here trying to cut this down. Before we finish on the field events, I would love to make mention of Al Erter, because it was a long time ago, starting in Melbourne in 56, Rome in 60, Tokyo 64, and Mexico 68, to win four successive throwing golds. I know Zalesny goes silver and then three successive golds. To win four golds in a row is unbelievable, especially when you bear in mind the American discus thrower had a near-fatal car crash. I'd forgotten this until I doubled my research to make sure of my facts. He had a near-fatal car crash in 1957, still managed to win in 60. He tore cartilage in his lower ribs in the lead-up to 64 and still managed to win the title. And then came from nowhere after an appalling season by his own high standards in Mexico in 68 to throw a PB in his fourth games, 64-78, which is still a handsome throw these days. Al Erter, the American, deserves to be in the conversation of all-time greats. Across four Olympics, he won four golds. Now, I know we've already talked, you know, in this series about Michael Phelps winning 23. Erter could only win one gold in each edition of the four games that he went to. So for me, his achievements absolutely match Phelps, because he's got one chance and he got it right every single time. The man's a legend.
Talking about maybe winning multiple medals, the next man could possibly have won 20, because he won the decathlon not once, but twice. But again, Rob, you only get awarded one medal for winning the decathlon. An absolute legend. And Transworld Sport caught up with a legend that is David Thompson.
All my life, for as long as I can remember, I always thought that I was going to be the best at something. I didn't know it was going to be sport or whether I was going to be a doctor or a musician or whatever. But I always thought that I was going to be different to other kids. I think it was my defining moment. I was either going to be the man I thought I was or I wasn't. You know, it's as simple as that. That's the great thing about sports, is that you win or you don't. The watch says you win, or the camera says whatever. But it's, for me, it's my defining moment. It was going to prove to me that I was the man that I'd always said I was.
Danny Thompson, again, one of our own. So we probably have a bias on this one, Rob. But do you remember watching him back in his heyday?
Oh, how could you forget?
Well, I wasn't born. Oh, that's how I
listen,
can forget.
Listen.
I have to only watch the archive.
Oh, listen. If you were a schoolboy or schoolgirl in the early to mid-80s, you knew all about Daley Thompson, because a bit like Usain Bolt, it wasn't just what he did, it's how he did it. I mean, who else in history has whistled during a national anthem? Daley's career is really fascinating, and there are, everybody, of course, looks to Moscow in 80 and LA in 84. But there are two other Olympic Games he appeared at that tell you volumes about the man and his natural talent. Daley went to Montreal in 76 when he was just 18 years of age, when Bruce Jenner was the champion. Now, that shows you the extent of his talent, that he was sufficiently adept at 10 different events to earn a place on the British team for Montreal. Didn't get close to the podium, but you can make a very strong case. Some athletes come out of nowhere, go to a first Games and win the gold, and they lap up the pressure and the situation. But in the case of many, many, many great male and female Olympians, they have had the experience of won games as an outsider, where they've got to understand how it works in the village, where you go, how you behave, how early you go to bed, how much you avoid the distractions of the village. And then when they go the next time as a favourite, it stands them in very, very good stead indeed. So the fact that Daly went to 76 was massive. And the other phenomenal performance, and this might sound a bit weird saying this, the other phenomenal performance from Daly was very, very nearly getting a bronze in Seoul in 88. One of the famous images is that his pole snapped during the pole vault competition in 88. He was only just run off the podium by a brilliant 1500 metre runner by another one of the athletes. He finished in fourth, and that would have been absolutely unbelievable to have been on three successive podiums. And another thing that people are very quick to forget, there was tension around Moscow, and the Russian crowd were quite choosy in who they applauded internationally. And remember, going back to the history, Margaret Thatcher had been in favour of Great Britain joining the Americans in boycotting Moscow. In the end, sense prevailed and the British team went. So I wouldn't say that there was a natural inclination for the Russians to be over the moon with great British performances. When Daly won in Moscow, there was a standing ovation from the Russian crowd. Virtually no international winner from outside Russia got the benefit of a standing ovation, and Daly did for the first of his two golds. So
why was that? He was so young still, 21, or what was it that...
Because of the size of his personality and the manner in which he did it. You know, there's famous pictures of Daly unable to, you know, standing over his rivals at the end of a 400. And it's an iconic photograph. I now, off the top of my head, can't remember whether it was Moscow or LA, but I actually think it might have been Moscow. And it looks like he's standing like this Goliath among crushed men. And he said, it was a pure fluke,
yeah,
because the only reason I was standing up, I couldn't find a space on the floor to collapse to, because there were already bodies strewn everywhere. But the fact that he came so close to a third medal in 88, the fact that he was given a standing ovation by the Russian crowd, he's one of the all-time great Olympians. He really is. We could carry on, you and I especially, talking about athletics all day long, but we've done the swimmers, we've done athletics. Let's move onto the water rather than in the water. And there's only one place to start, the iconic figure, Sir Steve Redgrave, who went five golds in a row, the last of which came after he promised everyone in 96 that he would retire. He was dealing with diabetes. He did go to Sydney. He did win the gold. And Transworld Sport were lucky enough to catch up with him as he reflected on two decades of near perfection in rowing.
Rowing is a very coordinated sport, but it's a very repetitive sport. You're doing the same movements over and over again. If you can't catch, throw or kick a ball, you normally end up rowing. You have to be very single-minded and focused on what you're doing, because you won't get the best out of yourself. Do I see myself as being selfish? I would answer that no. If you ask my family, they'd say yes. I know what I've achieved, and I'm proud of the goals that I've set myself and of some of my achievements and in some ways of my failures as well. My ambition within rowing was to be the men's single sculls Olympic champion, and that was going to be in 88. I failed at that. I might have five Olympic gold medals, but the one I wanted to get, I didn't achieve.
So he is the most successful male in Olympic rowing history, without a doubt. For me as well, Rob, the fact that it was over 16 years, just put that into perspective, 16 years consecutive Olympic Games. Rowing is a really, really difficult event as well. I don't know if you ever tried it. I actually went to try out for a rowing team yesteryear. And the training they get you to do, it's all about pull-ups and upper body strength, as you would imagine as well. Not my forte, I'm about strength in my legs here, but absolutely ridiculous, especially as well after 96 he wanted to retire. He'd had some health problems like you alluded to, and he did take a little bit of a step away, and he said, didn't he, publicly in the media as well, he says, anybody sees me close to a rowing boat again, shoot me. Well, they didn't, thankfully, because he came back 4 years later in Sydney and won yet again. And I was re-watching that race as well. I think they're about a second up it was halfway in that event. 2,000 metres, that's what they row. And then at the end, it came down to about 0.2, 0.3 to the Italians, but it was as close as you like. It was absolutely phenomenal. What a way to bow out his career.
Yeah, it was a very, very close race in the end. I think the four of them were coming to the end of this great period that they'd conjured together. And yeah, I mean, Redgrave like scraped himself out of the boat. The number of times I saw that blooming quote after Atlanta, if anybody sees me go anywhere near a boat, you can almost quote it verbatim. Look, you know, what Redgrave illustrated is that there are a small number of greats who've scaled the mountain again and again and again. There are so many we could mention from so many different sports. I'd love to draw your attention or just give a mention for two boxers. The Hungarian Laszlo Papp, the first boxer to go three in a row, middleweight champion in London in 1948, then light middleweight champion in Helsinki in 52 and Melbourne in 56. And then, surprisingly, I know we've got Muhammad Ali with 1960, frightened of flying, went to Rome. The only way they got him on the plane, this is a true story, I read it in a biography about him, the only reason he'd agree to go on the plane was if he was in the emergency exit seat and if he was wearing a parachute. How you pull a parachute if you come out of a plane 6 miles up, I don't know. But that's the only reason Ali got on the plane. But I will brush
over... Uncomfortable, really, sit there with a parachute.
Well, that's the only way he would go. He absolutely insisted. He had a horrific flight going to the trials from the Deep South to New York, or the flight back, and was petrified of flying his entire life. But I'm going to brush over Ali. The other boxer I'd love to mention is the majestic... I know we're talking about David Rudisha being majestic in the 800. Teofilo Stevenson, the Cuban. Absolutely unbelievable. Three successive golds, 72, 76 and 80, turned down two, bearing in mind this is the mid-70s and he's a Cuban, turned down a reported fee of $2 million to go pro and to go and fight Ali. And he said, "I love my country more than I love money." Teofilo Stevenson. For any youngsters listening or watching this, look him up. You know, that's the kind of figure that children should aspire to replicate. And not only did he go three in a row, he even became a world champion in 86 at the age of 34. Just an absolutely incredible figure. As is, boxing's an obvious one, isn't it? Because there are so many different nations represented. And we've talked about the likes of Redgrave. Some sports don't get the profile they deserve. We know that, and we can't give airtime to them all. Otherwise, this would be a 55-episode podcast. If anyone was with us from start to finish on that, they deserve an Olympic medal themselves. But one other sport that does get good headlines, because it is glitzy and glamorous and it works really well on TV, is gymnastics. And we've got to mention Vitaly Sherbo. 6 golds in Barcelona in 92. Then his wife has an accident. She's in a coma. He, you know, basically went off the rails and didn't know how to cope. And he managed to come back and win 4 bronze medals 4 years later in Atlanta after scraping his life back together. There's so many male gymnasts that we should mention, but Sherbo really is worthy of inclusion on that list of greats.
And he's continued, doesn't he, as well, to dedicate his life to gymnastics, because when he's retired as well, he's gone and opened up a school in Las Vegas for gymnastics, and that's actually where Transworld Sport caught up with him.
What is the purpose for the sportsman to go to Olympic Games? Just to be there? I don't think so, not for me. You don't think about fun or proudness of yourself than when you're an Olympics, no. This is your job, you're trying to do your best, trying to win. That's the whole point. I think that gymnastics was just, you know, I was born for. That's how I feel. But if not, I'll probably end up in jail. Some thief or criminal. 99% of my friends and my street.
That's a really, really interesting quote for Sherbo to finish with there, because we often look at what these great Olympians have done for their sport, but we don't always remember to think what the sport has done for them and how different their lives would have turned out had they not ended up being gymnasts, boxers, runners, jumpers, cyclists. And that's why the Olympics is so absolutely incredible, because It's like they're drawn together, these greats in their sport. They're drawn together like an irresistible magnet, and they resist the forces because they know how hard it's going to be. They know the rivalry is going to crush them psychologically, but they're closer and closer and closer together. And that's why it's so irresistible to watch, because when those magnets collide, there's electricity in the air. And that's why so many great performances come within the Olympic framework.
And Rob, we've just touched the surface as well, haven't we? I know we focus a lot on track and field. You know, that's probably down to us because we love that sport, you know, so much. Between the two of us, we've got such great experiences in that. Touched beyond swimming, you can't not, but we could have gone into the velodrome. We haven't talked about equestrian. There's so many sports that we haven't touched because there are so many. It's just so vast and we just don't have the time. But like kind of we've mentioned, go and have a little Google. Ask your mum and dad. Ask your best friend who they're inspired by, because you can find endless stories these days on the internet. Transworld Sport, as we've seen, have some absolutely great little gems there that you can just find out some great stories about these iconic champions of the past. But we've got to stop somewhere. This man could talk all day long, as you've seen. He'll get this little compendium out, because next up, we're going to talk about the greatest female Olympians of all time. I've got some great stories in this one. We know this man will have plenty more. So come and join us. Cannot wait.
Don't miss it.